Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Other F Word Podcast, where we talk about how to deal with failure. We appreciate y'all joining us, and remember to please rate and review and subscribe to the podcast, and feel free to email us at info@theotherfwordpodcast.com. We would love to hear your story ideas and your comments and your questions, so feel free to reach out to us. Now, on to today's episode. Today, we have author and essayist William Derezowitz, and he has a book that we're going to be discussing called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. It's very timely. We're going to touch on some of the topics that are kind of going on today.
Well, yeah, and it ties in very well, and it's very, very relevant to what's going on with the recent college cheating scandal, in which a bunch of parents were discovered to have committed fraud, actually paid and bribed coaches and administrators and all sorts of people in trying to get their kids into elite schools. And it was a whole ring that was discovered that was led by this one advisor, consultant. So that has been in the news, and we're going to address that.
Yep. And it's fascinating. You know, we're all parents, and a lot of parents we know and parents that I see in my practice everybody's talking about what is going on. Why is it so hard to see our kids fail? And what are parents doing showing their kids that it's okay to lie and cheat and steal in order to get what they want? How do we change this? It feels overwhelming, but something needs to change.
And also need to rethink what failure actually is, because is not getting into an elite Ivy League school actually really a failure? So anyway,
I guess it depends on the family you're in. But everybody's got their, I think, idealized vision for their children. And we're hoping people get in touch with what that looks like and how failure plays in. So
yeah, absolutely. So we're going to talk about it during this episode. Thanks so much for joining us. And on to the show.
Welcome to the Other F Word Podcast with Morgan,
Sarah,
and Melissa,
where we talk about that dreaded word, failure. Join us as we explore the messy, tragic, funny, and inspiring stories that make us human.
Well, William, thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. Your book is so timely, even though you wrote it a couple of years ago. So we'd love to hear about your book and kind of what brought you to write this book. And
sure. Yeah, it's an interesting story, and one that I didn't really see coming. I was an English professor at Yale for 10 years, from 98 to 2008. And before that, I had done a PhD at Columbia, where I spent a few years as a graduate instructor. So I was getting to know, I also went to Columbia College. So, I mean, I knew these students, and I was getting to know these students better and better as a professor at Yale in particular. And I was also the kind of professor, and there unfortunately aren't too many like this, who really like to spend time talking to students and listening to students and ask them about their life story and just being open to them if they needed guidance, if they needed mentorship, you know, in an open-ended way. And during my years at Yale, I was increasingly really distressed at what I was seeing among these students. First of all, the fact that so many of them didn't really seem to know what they wanted to do with their lives and didn't know how to go about doing it. And I would continue to hear from some of them, you know, for sometimes years after graduation, and they really continued to be unable to find their direction. Also, while they were almost universally really smart, really driven, hardworking, focused on their studies, on doing the work, very few of them really were interested in learning for its own sake, had real intellectual curiosity and saw school as kind of part of a larger project that they were conducting for themselves rather than just something that they were, you know, doing because they were supposed to do. And in fact, the few of them who really did fit that description felt really kind of alienated. They felt like the university was not set up for them. They felt like weirdos, right? So right around the time that I ended up leaving Yale, I wrote an essay about some of this stuff called The Disadvantages of an Elite Education. It came out in a fairly small literary quarterly. I didn't think a lot of people would see it. It wasn't written for students. I thought if anybody saw it, it would probably be fellow academics. It was written, quite frankly, in a way that was a little bit, or could come across as a little bit angry or sour, or like I didn't like these kids, which wasn't true, but I wasn't really, like I said, I didn't think any of them would read it. So this was 2008. And what happened, and again, this completely took me by surprise, was that almost immediately the piece went viral and started to be read thousands, tens of thousands, ultimately hundreds of thousands of times over the course of the next few years. And almost immediately, I started to hear from the people who were reading it. And it wasn't fellow academics. It was students like this. Students like this all across the country at elite private colleges and universities, or very recent graduates of those places. And almost all of these emails, many of which were long, confessional, sometimes full of a lot of pain and confusion, almost all of them said some version of, thanks for putting my experience into words.
Interesting. You know? Yeah.
The one thing that I didn't know that the emails showed me was not just the stuff that I talked about was true, that they were not feeling served by their education, that, and that they didn't know how to conduct their own lives, but how incredibly miserable the whole system was making them, like just really unhappy. You know, and I started to read about it. I started to investigate this, and I discovered that some books had been written about it, not about college students, but more about high school students. One is called The Price of Privilege. One is called Doing School. Now I think everyone is aware of this, but that was really my first understanding of this really epidemic of mental distress or even mental illness among high achieving students. I mean, mental illness in the sense of depression, in the sense of anxiety, suicidal behavior, suicide, substance abuse. It's a huge thing. And I also started to be invited to campuses to give talks, often by student groups. That's when I realized, you know, I had to talk about this more. I had to talk about this again. I had to write a book, and I specifically had to write a book that not only expanded on my critique and kind of clarified it for myself and fleshed it out, but also tried to offer some kind of answer to the question that I would get, which was, what am I supposed to do about this?
Right.
How can I save myself from this system? So that's what the book ended up being, and that's how I ended up writing it.
Yeah, and it's a great book. I really enjoyed it. And you refer to several reasons for this epidemic in your book. I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are several things that play into it, including one big thing that basically didn't exist in 2008, which was social media. I mean, it didn't exist in the big way that it does now. But leaving that aside, I would say that really, the whole thing that drives this is the selective college admissions process, because across a very wide swath of American society, it's been estimated about 10 to 15% of high school graduates. But basically, above a certain class level, it's everybody, right? In the upper class, the upper middle class, large parts of the middle class, this is sort of the goal that all of life is directed towards. It's basically producing a child that looks good on a college application. And this has been a system really that was put in place about 50 years ago, but it's what we call meritocracy. But it's just been getting worse and worse because it feeds on itself. So the more competition there is, the more competition there is. The more extracurriculars people do, the more they feel they need more AP courses.
Right.
So, I mean, I realized later that I had gone through the system myself in the late 70s, but it looks just increasingly crazy, right? So that's really it. I mean, kids are compelled to run this marathon of empty achievement, if not from first grade, then certainly from sixth or seventh grade. It doesn't mean anything to them personally because it isn't driven by their inner desires. Like, it's not like, I want to do this thing, I'm really interested in this subject, I'm really interested in becoming this type of person. It's more just like, I have to get into the best college. I can because that's what everyone is telling me I have to do. Otherwise, my life is going to be over. So this is why you get this incredible anxiety and panic, but also kind of emptiness, right? I mean, if you're working towards something you really care about, then you know, you'll work from the time you get up until the time you go to sleep, and you'll be very happy doing it if you're really into what you're doing. If you're just doing it because someone's holding a gun to your head, it feels awful.
Absolutely. There's no intrinsic sort of motivation except for a superficial one. There's no reward except something really superficial, which is also something you refer to, that kind of drive towards success versus actual either happiness or a sense of competency or, you know, there's no willingness to take risks. There's no real search for, as it says on the cover of your book, for a meaningful life. And that no doubt is a huge factor as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as we all know, we all need a sense of meaning. I think young adults especially are looking for a sense of meaning. You might even say, well, maybe you don't necessarily need to get it in school, and I think that's true. I think it's good if school helps you. But if school occupies every single waking moment of your life because of this achievement race, school or extracurriculars, I mean, it's all really the same, internships, then you better get it at school. Your school better help you, at least.
Right. And I know, Bill, in my practice with adolescents, a lot of times they talk about that they can't even do things that bring meaning or joy to their lives because it will take away from the other stuff that is deemed more important, because that big goal of getting into the best school. I'm curious where you see that pressure coming from. You know, is it coming from college and trickling down? Is it coming from parents at the beginning and kind of, you know, inching kids' way up through the school system? You know, again, here at the Other F Word, where we talk about failure, we're trying to help parents and teachers understand the value of failure and change the system along with children. Children seem to be more eager to do that, but they feel like it doesn't matter because the adults around them, whether it's the system or their families, don't know how to do that or don't allow for that. So I'm curious, where do you see it, the pressure coming from?
Well, this is exactly the problem. I mean, I think the pressure is coming from everywhere all at once, and it's coming on everyone all at once.
Yeah.
It's not just the kids who are under pressure. The parents feel under pressure because they, you know, they feel like if their kid isn't one of the winners, then they're going to be one of the losers.
Mm.
High schools are under pressure from the parents and the teachers specifically, you know, both from the parents and from their bosses at high schools. The colleges, in a sense, are competing with each other, although, you know, they're sort of the most selective colleges are certainly some of the greatest beneficiaries of all this. But even they're in a competition with each other. And ultimately, I think what's structuring this is inequality, right? The worse inequality gets, the more pressure people are going to feel under. And also part of inequality is the relentless decline in public spending on things like higher education or K-12 education. Mm-hmm. So students don't have the option that they would have had 30 or 50 years ago of going essentially for free or literally for free to a really good public university.
Right.
I like to say that it's a system, not just in a loose sense, but it's a system in the sense of a set of tightly interlocking parts, mm. The kids, the parents, the schools, you know, the high schools, the colleges, et cetera. And each sort of actor, each node in this system is responding to the forces that are impinging on that node, right? So they have very little freedom of action. I mean, how many times have I heard parents, and I've spoken to a lot of parent groups, mainly at high school, how many times have I heard parents express the desire that they could raise their children differently, but they just feel like that isn't an option?
I
think it can be an option. I think it should be an option. I think people are a lot more panicked than they need to be,
mm-hmm.
Especially parents who are relatively well off. Mm-hmm. I think they exaggerate the threat to their children, but still, it's legitimate.
Well, and I think also something you said that's kind of fascinating to me is it's not like, from what I understood your experience to be, like these kids are getting into these schools And then it's like the big reward is that you are ultimately happy and it's joyful. It's like that anxiety, that stress just continues with them. So it's hard to even see what the ultimate end is that doesn't end up in just anxiety and depression ultimately. You know, it's not like you get there and you're like, hey, I did it. I'm here. This is fun. Let's have it, you know?
Well, this is what's so sad. And I mean, one of the saddest things for me is when I hear, you know, high school seniors, because I'm at a high school, or when I was a professor and I had freshman advisees, which means that I would meet with them even before classes started freshman year. And people, and they'll say the high school students or the kids who just got to college, you know, now that I got to college, everything will be different. And it's really sad for me because I know perfectly well that it's not going to be different. And these freshmen are going to find out inside of about 2 months that it's not different, because they will discover that there's a whole new set of, you know, hoops that they have to jump through and brass rings that they're supposed to clutch for. And, you know, that never stops. I mean, it's sort of the logic of this kind of empty ambition or status seeking, that there's always something more to want. There's always someone else to compare yourself to. And if you don't, you know, deliberately make it, exert yourself to kind of stop the momentum of that, you're just going to be miserable like this. You're going to be a miserable workaholic your entire life, or maybe until you hit like a midlife crack up, which is kind of what midlife crises are often about, right?
Right, right. And yet you have described going through somewhat of a that type of experience where you started on that track and you felt the pressure from your family to be a doctor, and obviously were successful enough to get into the Ivy Leagues. But then what was it that happened for you that stopped you and changed, allowed you to change tracks and follow what you really were interested in?
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't make any claims other than that I'm exactly this kind of person. I was exactly this kind of kid. I was raised this way. I mean, I don't think anyone here is sort of a saint about that. It's the kind of thing that you have to deal with and have to fight against. And in some ways, those needs, I've not overcome them and I'll never overcome them. It's really just a matter of being aware of them and not allowing them to control your decisions. So I think for me, and this is what I say to students too, I mean, I'll say to students, look inside yourself, you know, get in touch with your feelings. And if this is all working for you, then just keep doing it. I'm not going to tell you not to do it if it's working for you, if it's making you happy. But if it's not, then you should recognize that it's not going to change and you should do something about it. And I think that that's really, without having had that kind of guidance, that's what ended up happening with me. I just realized, like, I didn't want to be a doctor. I didn't want to be a science major. I wanted to study something else. I didn't want to do the things that everybody was telling me that I wanted to do. They weren't making me happy. I didn't think they would make me happy in the future. I didn't want to be among the people who did those kinds of things. I didn't want to be with other doctors. It wasn't, you know, I was interested in other things. I was interested in reading books, and it took a long time. I did major in science because nobody sort of helped me give myself the permission to be an English major. And it took until 4 years after I graduated from college, which means there was a lot of wasted time, mm-hmm. before I finally did give myself the permission to go and study English Lit. And, you know, even though everybody thought, like, what happened to this guy? He had been so promising, and now his life has gone off the rails. My parents were very upset. You know, they didn't think I'd ever be able to support myself. But, you know, first of all, it's my life. So if I'm miserable, that's my business. And second of all, I think generally people are more successful in the best sense if they study and go into professionally the things that really turn them on. Yeah. And also I think, and parents, I think, forget this. You know, young people have a lot of resiliency. They have a lot of energy. They have a lot of optimism. They can do things not only that surprise their parents, but that surprised them. You know, I didn't know that anything would work out with me. It worked out. Doesn't always work out, but at least, you know, even when it doesn't work out, better that it doesn't work out because you tried to do something you cared about.
Mm-hmm. Which is such hard wisdom for young adults to learn, especially when they're on that track of kind of automatic functioning, or functioning in a way that they've been told to do. And so having this dialogue, and I think the recent college admission scandal going on in the world right now, is forcing people to talk about what's going on, what's wrong, why is this happening? And I'm curious your take on it right now.
Well, I mean, okay, so here's my take. Obviously, parents are getting crazier and crazier. Yes. And those who are wealthy and entitled become increasingly wealthy and increasingly entitled and apparently increasingly immoral. Mm-hmm. I think this scandal for me was one of those things that was shocking but not surprising. Mm-hmm. But the real scandal is not the illegality, nor is it some of the things that we've been talking about, like the legal use of donations to vastly increase your chances of getting in, big ticket donations, the so-called backdoor that this guy was talking about to parents. Right. Nor even is it the, I think now, multi-billion-dollar test prep, college consulting, et cetera, industry, mm-hmm. through which affluent parents increase their kids' chances of getting in. Right. You could take all of those things away.
Right.
And affluent parents, and I mean upper middle class as well as upper class, professional class, not the top 1%, but the top 10 or 20%, their kids would have enormous advantages just because they go to so much better schools, so much better primary and secondary schools. Mm-hmm. That is the main way. Our educational system is supposed to mitigate inequality and increase social mobility, and it's doing the opposite. Mm. And it does the opposite because some kids get more, and some kids get less. And affluent parents, either by moving to suburbs, usually, that have good public schools that are funded, you know, from property taxes and also from a lot of supplemental donations from parents, or by paying for private schools, are able to send their kids to schools that are so much better than the average kid, let alone a poor kid, can go to. The facilities are so much better. The opportunities are so much better. The teachers are better paid. It's really obscene. And the problem, this is why the student populations at selective colleges and universities, including the best public universities, skew so heavily to the upper end of the income distribution. You know, a huge percentage of students at those schools are rich. And they always will be, because those institutions, well, specifically the private ones, which is the great majority of them, need a critical mass of wealthy kids. That's never going to change.
Right.
So to me, the whole system is fundamentally corrupt, quite frankly. And what we really need to do if we want to address it is fund education the way we need to, and in some ways the way we used to, so that every kid really does have a chance.
Right. Yeah. Have you done any research around how lower income families or kids succeed, or what their experiences are as compared to the kids at the who you've polled to date? If in fact coming from a less privileged background and working for it harder and being less entitled or feeling maybe less on that track because you were never really on it to begin with, that there's a difference in their levels of happiness or even in achievement and kind of a sense of self and a clearer focus in life, how they compare to the elite class.
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if work has been done on that. I feel like I might've come across one or two, you know, news articles about research like that. I'm not aware of it. I would say this, though. I'm certainly aware of anecdotal evidence. I knew and still know lower-income kids who went to elite colleges. And yes, they tend to not have the same kinds of neuroses. They tend to be more resilient. I think also, since it's really hard for you, generally speaking, to decline in class. In other words, the more you have growing up, the harder it's going to be for you to do with less. So the harder it is for you to like make a choice to say be a teacher or an artist.
Right.
And if you grow up with less, it's actually easier, and that can be a big advantage. And I've talked to a lot of people who've said that.
Right.
But even if we, I mean, I don't want to be sentimental or romantic about this, but even if we postulate that kids from lower income backgrounds are sort of more resilient and maybe more whole as people, I don't really think that makes up for the incredible socioeconomic disadvantages they've been put at. And we know perfectly well, that in the aggregate, social mobility has gotten much slower, which means that if you start at the bottom, it's really hard for you to rise.
Absolutely.
And if you start at the top, it's really easy for you to stay at the top.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, whether you're happy or not, that's a separate question.
Right.
I don't think you're happy if you're poor either. I mean, I appreciate that there you can be happy, but I mean, it's not a happy situation.
Right. When you're wanting for so much.
And you're wanting and you can't give your kids anything and it sucks.
Right. Which I think is what created such a crazy making reactions or shock about this recent scandal. I think perhaps sometimes people can understand desperate measures that parents take when they are feeling desperate to provide for their children, whether it's financial or whether it's just basic shelter and you know, food or education. But for these privileged families who can give so much, why did they have to cheat the system? And what is that? Obviously, what's that? The lesson they're giving to their children. But I wonder, do you think that there will be a change in the system now because of all of this?
No.
Okay. I'm a little bit of an optimist.
No. Like so many things, we're going to talk about it for a few minutes and then we're going to forget about it. And the reason that it's not going to change, again, is that there's such powerful forces keeping it in place. As long as, did you say Trump?
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's not Trump. It is not Trump. I'm sorry. To get a little upset about this. This is not Trump's fault. Okay, if the liberal elite wants to look at itself in the mirror, then maybe we can make some progress here. Because they're, you know, it's a bipartisan problem of the elite. I don't mean to single out the liberal elite, but the liberal elite claims to stand for different values, just like these Hollywood actors. And some of the key institutions of the liberal elite are the Ivy League universities that profess their great moral virtue and their great moral mission. But these are the ones, the reason it's not going to change is not because of Trump, it's because of Harvard and all of the institutions like Harvard. And the problem is that we've outsourced the training of our leadership class to private institutions that will always put their own interests first.
Mm-hmm.
They are not dedicated to the public interest. They're dedicated to meeting their own budgets. And they need a lot of rich kids, and they're going to enroll them, whether they do it through legacy or through donation or through athletics or just because, like I said, the system is so uneven because of the primary and secondary, you know, the K-12 education system in this country. They're always going to do that. We cannot look to those institutions to solve this problem.
Right.
They can't. Even if they wanted to, they don't. They can't. We need to tax ourselves. We in the top 10 to 20% need to tax ourselves more so that other people's kids have more, even if it means our kids have less or have less of an advantage over other kids.
Yes, absolutely. And just to clarify, I wasn't connecting Trump to this. It was more of a sense of hopelessness about not being able to change something that feels corrupt and out of control. So it was just kind of a parallel experience of when there's so much power and there's greed and that these systems are hard to change. So thank you for clarifying.
Sorry, I over.
No, it's a very passionate topic. It is. It is. We know.
You know, it's interesting for me coming from the Southeast, originally from Alabama and then Florida, where there are state schools that are becoming harder to get into, but you could still, like, let's say you live in Alabama, you can go to the University of Alabama in general and you can get in and you can go to Birmingham and get a good job because it's like roll tide, everybody. And you know, my brother went to the University of Georgia. Like, you go to Atlanta, you can get a really good job with the Georgia degree. If you live in LA, my wife went to UCLA. My kids love UCLA. It is really hard to get into UCLA. So it's created this weird thing. Like, I'm out here and people don't know where to go to their kids to go to school. And it's a different situation than I kind of grew up with. So I wonder, is that escalating? Maybe it's different now and maybe it's harder to get into those schools, but is that something you see where it's just harder to get into state schools and they become more competitive? So then where do you send your kids? And 'cause I think that might've contributed to kind of what happened in the LA area, at least for those here.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. I think the Southeast has a different culture around this in a number of respects. The elite schools, which tend to be located elsewhere, are less of a thing. The state schools seem to be more important in terms of employment and leadership networks. I mean, I've experienced this firsthand. I've been down there. I've been at Mississippi University, Mississippi. I've been in Mississippi State. And I understand what you're talking about. I think in part, quite frankly, I think it's connected to the fact that the Southeast is more backwards economically, because what it means is that the networks are still more local, right? So, it's less part of a national, let alone a global economy. So what you said about, going to University of Alabama and being plugged into the employment and leadership networks in the state is absolutely true, but at the sacrifice of not being plugged in anywhere else. For various reasons, mainly because state support across the board has been declining, state schools in general, wherever they are increasingly looking to enroll out-of-state students who pay out-of-state tuition. So it is getting harder, as I understand, to get in even Southeastern schools. You know, Georgia wants kids from Mississippi, Alabama, and so on and so forth. I think California is sort of the worst of all for various reasons, very populous state, and I think because the public universities are so good, especially the best ones, UCLA, Berkeley, a lot of people from out of state want to go there. But again, California passed Prop 13 in 1978, and that was the beginning of the defunding of public higher ed. And Berkeley and all the other UC schools at that point were free.
Right.
As until the early 80s. Mm. And then that's all gone away. And now kids have trouble, even if you do enroll, they have trouble getting into the classes they need to graduate.
Right. God, everywhere you turn, it's hard. One of the many schools I went to was a junior college. And I remember feeling like such a failure because I was on a track for a four-year college and I didn't go. And I went to a junior college and I was ashamed about it. And yet, obviously, in hindsight, it worked for me, and I was able to, go on to get my master's years later. But I think a lot of kids and a lot of families who can't afford or can't get into a four-year college, junior college or community college is a great option, but there's so much stigma attached that families and children feel like failures. And I wonder if you see that and some thoughts you have, again, as we're trying to help people embrace what has been a stigma of failure and turn around to look at it. If it works for you, then that's a success.
It's funny. This has been coming up more and more as I travel around and give talks and listen to people. Community college in particular, I've really started to hear a lot about it just, I would say, in the last year. And I agree. I think they're unfairly stigmatized. I think they can be really good places to go for a year or two, if your ultimate goal is a 4-year degree. They're often really underfunded, but they can still be really good places with really dedicated teachers who are committed to teaching as opposed to professors at research university. And a lot of families, I think, are beginning to make this choice again to go for a year or two, save money that way. I know that in California, in particular, I think because of the way that affirmative action has been struck down, schools like Berkeley are increasingly turning to community college transfers to help them get back some of that diversity. And I was at Berkeley like 2-3 years ago, and they told me something like 40% of their students there are community college transfers. So I definitely think, but of course there's a huge stigma around it. And right. I think we need to confront it by having conversations like this and saying that it's stupid. And, I was just at Williams College, which is perennially the number one ranked liberal arts college in U.S. News, in that, the liberal arts college category. And I met a community college transfer student who was also a veteran who was, and a little bit older, who was an amazing person. And actually was, to go back to what you were asking before, was free of all this sort of nonsense about doing as many extracurriculars as possible, so much so that you don't have time to think about what you're studying. Mm-hmm. And he was just immersing himself headlong in whatever the most interesting courses he could find were. I think he was a philosophy major. Mm-hmm. And, So I think parents really need to rethink this sort of, there's only one way, you know, and if I can't shove my kid into that one way, then all is lost.
Absolutely. And tolerate some different possibilities, which may actually even recheck, you know, check yourself. People so quickly go to that idea of black and white and right and wrong and, you know, failure and success. And I think it's checking those tropes and those ideas that we have. But one of the things...
Well, can I just say one thing about that?
Yeah, of course.
And also, I mean, when we talk about the stigma around community college, it's what we're really talking about is status and status competition.
Totally.
And status anxiety.
Right.
And this is, to me, is what connects to the parents who are bribing their kids way into college. Because you ask, you know, what could they possibly, what are they worried about? Mm-hmm. And if you read, I've been reading a lot of the news coverage of this. This guy, this singer, I think his name was, he said that he would get a lot of calls from parents Sunday mornings, because they had gone to the dinner party the night before and they heard their friends' parents brag about all the wonderful things their kids were doing. And then they were calling the next morning in a panic, you got to get my kid into Stanford. So really the stigma against community college is part of the same disease that had these very wealthy parents buying their kids way into Stanford and USC and so forth. Right. We're all caught up in this. These parents were not different. They just happened to have the means.
That's right.
Do
that's
this.
Right. That's right. And that's exactly what I was going to say, is what I see all across the board in working with families is this worry. Whether they have money or not, there is a worry. Is my kid going to be okay? Is my child going to function? Is my child going to be an adult? And what have I done to provide that? And again, some parents have so much anxiety of their own that they don't feel they have provided enough, so go to great lengths to do it. So I think that parental worry is huge.
It is, but I really want to tease out two different things. I think it's really important to be clear about this. One is anxiety about sort of financial security. Is my kid going to be okay? Are they going to be able to make a living? I think it's legitimate, but highly exaggerated, especially among upper middle class parents.
Yes.
Okay. The other thing is not that. It's status anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's not. And I think parents have to be honest with themselves. Mm-hmm. It's not just that they're worried about their kid's future. They also want the gold star of their kid getting into a fancy college that they can then humble brag about to their friends. Okay. And that there's no legitimacy at all. That's just a real waste.
That's ego. Just all ego driven.
That's just all ego. And parents really need to, they really need to not impose that on their kids, because it's very damaging.
Right. And again, because I don't know all of the players involved, I would wonder if in these cases, or which ones, was there legitimate worry that their kid was not functioning at the right level and that they needed to overcompensate, not for a status, not for shame or stigma that, you know, we're an elite family and our child is, you know, low functioning, but was there any kind of real anxiety that they could speak about? I've yet to hear that, but I imagine.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, but look, I mean, if their kid is a dum-dum, then I don't think it's going to help to like send them to a college where they're going to be so far below
right. The
typical student. That's really not the answer for a kid like that.
Well, hopefully that's what parents will hear, because a lot of parents don't take the time to think that through and throw their kids into, you know, the lion's den, and then they're screwed. So,
yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, though. I do think this is with social media now, these stories come out and it is such an attack on these people who did this, which I get. They did a rough thing, and I think they're going to deal with consequences. But I also think we miss something if we all don't look at how we do this to our kids as well. You know, it's like we don't have the means to do this, but we all are putting pressure and trying to keep up with our next door neighbor, however level that is, even if it's just going to something small. You know, this is all in all of us. So I think we do a little bit of a disservice if we just say those people over there with a ton of money, well, they have the means to do it, but we're all doing it. We're all a part of social media. We all have this same thing in us this same ego that can kind of trip us up. So I think it's opportunity for us, if we use it, to look at ourselves too, and how am I contributing to this, you know?
That's exactly right. And again, I mean, you know, sort of the typical upper middle class family, the typical family of a kid who gets into a selective college, they've done it partly with money too, by paying for opportunities. But then, because it's not just purely money, it's money plus your kid, you know, slaving through years and years of, you know, of all the stuff we've been talking about. It's like money plus the tears of your child, of you know, this empty, endless, meaningless work
raised to
that
nowhere.
Makes up the difference, you know, between you and a really rich family that just, you know, buys the building.
Right.
So, yeah.
I think it's so great in your book that you have a whole section devoted to what kids can do. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to that and what you advise.
Right. Well, to go back to what we were saying about the system and how everyone is acting on the forces that impinge on them. When I talk to students or even parents, the next thing I say is, but the freest actor in all of this is the student, because they don't have to worry about losing their job like a high school teacher. They don't have to worry about feeding their kids because they are the kids. They don't have any kids now. They're free now. So they can, you know, as you already know, I don't really believe that systemic solutions are forthcoming. I'd like them to be. I don't believe that they're going to be. But the individual kid can save themselves. I don't have any sort of magic answers for that, except really, I think the magic is becoming aware of what it is that you're part of, and becoming aware of how you feel about it. I think the two most powerful things are the recognition that you're not happy. And a lot of kids, especially in high school, I think it's younger, it's really hard for them even to get in touch with their feelings, even to see what they're feeling. I mean, I think even through young adulthood, it can be very hard to really, really admit to yourself that you're not happy. And then the second thing is, you don't have to do this.
Yeah.
You don't have to do this. It might mean defying your parents. And I talk with students a lot about defying your parents or defying your peers. Defying the whole environment around you, but remembering that it's your life, remembering that not caring what other people think about your choices is one of the best things you can do for yourself. Mm-hmm. And then also, I mean, I tend to have a more conflictual attitude towards the parent-child relationship, maybe because mine was like that, and I do think that some conflict is necessary. But also, especially in a generation where there seems to be less generational friction, it doesn't have to be necessarily a fight with parents. I think part of the problem, and people talk about this with helicoptering, is that the communication is all in one direction. The parent is issuing instructions, but isn't hearing about what the kid isn't really hearing from the kid. So if kids can communicate with their parents, and if parents can help kids communicate with them, by really listening in a non-judgmental way and refraining from kind of imposing their panic, their anxiety onto them, and letting kids say, like, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. This is where I think I want to go to college. This is what I care about. Helping, I mean, the anecdote to sort of extrinsic motivation and empty ambition is to start to figure out what it is that you do care about, what it is that you are good at.
Yeah.
And parents can hinder that or they can help that.
Yep. So beautifully said. So beautifully said. And it sounds so simple, and yet it's so challenging for so many families. And yet I hope people can listen to this and really, what we always talk about is to slow down and to get really present and to listen to each other. And young adults and teenagers and children, they have a lot to say that's really important. And it will actually help adults to know how to navigate and how to help grow these kids up, as opposed to force them into a box that they don't fit in. So such wisdom today, Bill / William.
okay. I mean, listen, it's like you said, it's easy to say what needs to be done.
Yeah.
To do it is hard. It's a whole process, but You know, I think kids and parents can be allies with each other instead of adversaries, instead of enemies.
Absolutely. And learn to sit in failure and trust that you will learn and grow from it, and that it is part of life, not something to avoid. That's really what's at the heart of so much of this. So thank you for joining us in our conversation.
Sure. My pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Bill. Really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. And where do you want people to find you and connect with you? Because obviously a big step in the direction of helping this is your book and the work you're doing. So is there a certain website?
Yeah, I've got a website. It's BillDurezowitz.com. And I'm sure on your website there'll be the spelling of my name. The book is Excellent Sheep, which is easy to Google, and you can find your way to my website from that. And I'd love to hear from people. And I love to come and talk at high schools if people are interested. That's where, you know, so much of the important work it needs to happen.
Absolutely.
But yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks so much. And go visit the website, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Bill. Really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Other F Word Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast, and visit us online at theotherfwordpodcast.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And we'd love to hear your stories of struggle with failure. You can contact us at info@theotherfwordpodcast.com. See you next time.